Thank you, Diane, for having me to Sim. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to be able to share a little bit tonight. I was given the invitation to speak on the topic of my choosing, so the topic is based on sort of what's alive for me in my own practice and my own life at the moment. So I would sometimes, this is said at the end of Dharma talks, I'll say it at the beginning to invite you to take whatever is helpful and leave whatever is not helpful. And also that the views presented herein may not necessarily be the views of Sim. So the title of the presentation is Dharma Practice and Psychotherapy, I think, but really I'll be speaking a little bit about how Dharma practice and a psychotherapeutic or sort of Western psychological approach can be mutually complementary. And this isn't really a new, I'm not saying anything new. There's a lot of people who have written about this and spoken about it and thought about it. But as I said, this is sort of the edge of my own practice with what I'm working with and what I'm excited about. So I was happy to be able to come and share a little bit about it. So there's a traditional distinction between what we might consider two separate and distinct paths of human development: the path of meditation, enlightenment, mystical experiences, non-ordinary states of consciousness, and the path of psychotherapy or psychological development. So different traditions usually emphasize one over the other, and both can be useful and mutually supportive, but sometimes there can be problems that come up when there's an imbalance between the two. So I've always thought that I like hearing people's stories about how they come to Dharma practice, because to me it seems that they often involve some degree of suffering or vulnerability about the suffering of the human experience. So the bottom line of why a lot of us, I don't know, maybe all of us come to Dharma practice is because we suffer, and we, with the intention of not suffering or not suffering unnecessarily. So there's this line, apparently from the Buddha, that he says, "I teach one thing and one thing only, which is suffering and the end of suffering," which I don't know if that's one thing or two things, but so both Dharma practice and psychotherapy are motivated by an intention to alleviate suffering and to cultivate well-being. So part of this interest in looking at this intersection for me came, part of it came from my own experience, but also came from observing kind of how this was presented by Dharma teachers. And I have one memory of being in this retreat that Diane spoke about with Bhikkhu Anālayo, where he was referencing a conversation that he had with Jack Kornfield, where he was saying something to the extent of, for most people, meditation is enough, and Dharma practice will get you where you need to go. But for a few people, they need psychotherapy too. And so in my own experience, I did come to Dharma practice when I was in a moment of crisis in my own life. I was in a lot of suffering. I also did therapy at that time. I'm still in therapy. I love Dharma practice. I decided to become a psychotherapist. And so I felt a little bit uncertain about kind of how to integrate or understand these two paths together. So I asked one teacher about this issue of, is just sitting enough? Is meditation enough? And this is a Dharma teacher who I really like and respect and who I know has done a lot of therapy herself. And her answer was, usually it's the teachers that say, meditation is enough. That's the, you only need meditation. They're the ones that need psychotherapy the most. So whether we're talking about Dharma or psychotherapy, it's helpful to consider what our intention is. What's the bottom line? So traditionally, the intention of Dharma practice is freedom or liberating insight that leads to the end of suffering for ourselves or for others. It's waking up. It's about how we live, who we are, how we treat others. So with this in mind, for me, it's helpful to look closely at what supports this intention. So whether we're talking about Dharma or meditation, Dharma practice, psychotherapy, it's really looking at what is skillful means supporting the intention of waking up rather than blindly following some prescription or dogma. So one invitation of spiritual practice, as I understand it, and of psychotherapy, is to bring ourselves into alignment with what is true, how to be skillful with ourselves and with others, how to have the courage to engage with our difficult human life as fully as possible, which doesn't mean just feeling good or feeling happy. And this reminded me of a quote that I've always liked from Joseph Campbell, which is neither Dharma nor psychotherapy per se. He says that people say that what we're all seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical plane will have resonances with our own innermost being and reality, so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. So this is all sort of by way of introducing this theme. And I'll be making the case essentially for complementing a Dharma practice with a sort of psychological understanding of oneself. And so with that said, I also want to say that I do think it's important also to that I'm not recommending kind of taking a little bit of this and a little bit of that and sort of that it's all a smorgasbord. But I think it can be very helpful to find a specific approach, a tradition, a lineage, a sitting group, a home sangha to stick with, because this supports going deep and supports the progression of insight. So a little bit about looking at a Buddhist view, a basic Buddhist view, and a basic psychotherapeutic view. So the basic Buddhist view comes from the 2500 or 2600-year-old tradition of investigating the fundamental questions about our human experience. It's complex with many different theories and approaches, but basic to most or all Buddhist views is the claim that an independently existing self is the central source of unnecessary suffering and confusion in our lives. Also common to most Buddhist views is the premise that we only live in the present moment. So past conditioning shapes what arises in this moment, and how we engage with this moment profoundly affects what will arise in the next moment. From this perspective, how we engage with our present reality and our experience has a more powerful impact on our state of mind than what we are experiencing. So by training ourselves to bring awareness to our immediate embodied experience, we can discover for ourselves what is most true in each moment. And as we increase our capacity to consciously participate in our moment-by-moment experiencing, we may find less and less evidence of a stable and continuing self. The techniques we use for this investigation are known as meditation. The basic Western psychotherapeutic approach is based on the idea that the experiences we have as children, usually in our families of origin, have a profound impact on us for the rest of our lives. In response to difficulty, we adapt by developing coping strategies and behavioral patterns that help us deal with what we experience as threats to our emotional or physical survival as children. While we develop these strategies as a temporary tool to help us survive early in life, we later use them as generalized ways of engaging in life and with other people. Because in our minds, these strategies are associated with survival and safety, we often cling to them with desperation, even on a biological level. Many of the so-called dysfunctions therapists work with are associated with these out-of-date survival strategies. So I have a quote from the journal Pediatrics, which I think is associated with Harvard Center for some Center for Childhood Development. So this is a non-New Agey understanding of this idea that says, growing scientific evidence demonstrates that social and physical environments that threaten human development because of scarcity, stress, or instability can lead to short-term physiologic and psychological adjustments that are necessary for immediate survival and adaptation, but which may come at a significant cost to long-term outcomes in learning, behavior, health, and longevity. So to give one example of this, one example that I could think of would be to say that as children we had to disconnect from our conscious experience of anger. So in our family of origin, say, to feel anger, to express anger, might have been dangerous. Maybe it was dangerous. Maybe our parents themselves didn't have a conscious and kind relationship with their own experience of anger. And so if we were to express anger, we would have been less likely to get our own needs met. Then repressing that anger would have been an appropriate and intelligent thing to do. But then later as adults, we might feel anxiety or even panic anytime anger or strong emotion comes up in ourselves or in others. So these strategies, which often operate outside of our conscious awareness, will continue, possibly for the rest of our lives, until we decide to challenge them as adults. I have another quote from another teacher that says, children in particular find strong negative emotions too overwhelming to cope with and attempt not to feel them. In the absence of a fully conscious adult who guides them with love and compassionate understanding in facing the emotion directly, choosing not to feel it is indeed the only option for the child at that time. Unfortunately, that early defense mechanism usually remains in place when the child becomes an adult. That emotion still lives in him or her, unrecognized, and manifests, for example, as anxiety, anger, outbursts of violence, a mood, or even as physical illness. In some cases, it interferes with or sabotages every intimate relationship. So in psychotherapeutic work, one of the first steps is beginning to see that the recurring patterns we experience in the present are not caused by or even necessarily about the current life circumstances or current relationships. These strategies, although often maladaptive in that they create more problems than they were created to solve, don't arise necessarily out of a pathology or bad intentions. Rather, they're just our young efforts to take the best care of ourselves possible, only that now, as adults, they're some decades out of date. So to be clear, we're not talking about going back into our history and reworking some past experience, but rather about how our past conditioning manifests in the present. Another way of looking at this issue from the psychotherapeutic approach is to say that neurosis develops as a logical way of escaping difficult experience. And there's this quote from Carl Jung who says, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. So how our childhood strategies become our adult neurosis or neuroses is one of the basic themes of Western psychology.
Can you define neurosis?
Define neurosis. So trying to think of what would be a good example. So if we understood depression or anxiety or some phobia, something that outwardly would be considered some sort of pathology or that we're not adapting in a seemingly successful way to our relationships or our outward circumstances. And so from the outside, it looks like there's something going wrong. But internally, these things they have a certain internal logic that either in the past or in some cases in the present are adapting to help us get our needs met. I think we're going to have a little bit of time for questions at the end. If we could hold off till then, I think that might be a little bit better. So over the past 10 or 15 years, as probably all of you know, mindfulness has been really inundating the world of psychology. So even in traditional scientific journals and conferences, you hear terminology like metta and choiceless awareness, and even more sort of explicitly Buddhist terminology is coming in. And it's interesting that it's not the more kind of woo-woo parts of psychology that are employing mindfulness. It's more the more conservative approaches, the more kind of cognitive behavioral camps, and it's being used in very productive ways with a lot of enthusiasm. Steve Hayes, who's the originator of acceptance and commitment therapy, says in a New York Times article, "There's been a shift from having our mental health defined by the content of our thoughts to having it defined by our relationship to that content and changing that relationship by sitting with, noticing, and becoming disentangled with our definition of ourselves." So mindfulness has become an explicit intervention in itself, maybe most famously with MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, but also with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, for relapse prevention. It's being used for an array of approaches to human suffering where mindfulness is at the center. Mindfulness has also been shown to improve effectiveness with clinicians, with therapists that meditate. They've done studies that show that the outcomes are better regardless of what kind of therapy they're practicing. Same kind of therapist, same kind of therapy, but with the meditating therapist, the outcomes are improved. So are there any problems with the situation of mindfulness in psychology? Is there any problem when mindfulness is taken as a tool in and of itself outside of the context in which it originated? Even when mindfulness is included in psychotherapy, there's still a significant difference in the depth of aspiration and possibility for well-being between a mindfulness-informed psychotherapeutic approach and a Dharma path approach. Freud famously said that the aim of psychoanalysis was to turn hysterical misery into common unhappiness. So probably on our Dharma paths, we aspire to more than common unhappiness. So even with good therapy, we might not touch some of the dimensions of well-being that can come from contemplative practice. We might even not know that they exist. Dharma practice also adds other components that aren't present with psychotherapy alone. Perhaps one of the most important is the addition of, or the emphasis that's placed on, ethical conduct, or the claim that deep abiding happiness can't come when we're out of line with our own ethical impulses and our deepest intentions for non-harming. So if we're teaching mindfulness without some of the views that accompany a more comprehensive understanding of these attitudes that can lead to deeper well-being, then we might be cutting ourselves short. As Sayadaw Utejaniya says, awareness alone is not enough. So to review a little bit, as we've said, from the perspective of Dharma practice and contemplative traditions more generally, the relative or conventional self, or the ego, is considered to be not only illusory, but the very cause of all the suffering in our lives. The suffering is ended when we let go of the illusory self and experientially discover the lack of any abiding, stable self, a discovery known as awakening or enlightenment. As we said, the basic technique for this process is called meditation. The conventional Western psychological approach takes the ego as the highest self we have. Only suffering and unhappiness in this model comes from the unhealthy or dysfunctional version of the ego. This approach thinks that the healthy ego is very real and authentic. Indeed, it is our highest self. And it's only problematic when it becomes dysfunctional and causes problems. And the basic technique for converting the dysfunctional self into the healthy self is called psychotherapy. So contemplative approaches, including the Dharma, lump together all finite selves. They don't distinguish necessarily between healthy and unhealthy ego, between accurate and inaccurate self-image. They see that both selves are finite, relative, and conventional. And from this perspective, both selves are equally worthless. This is why it isn't uncommon to find people who have had deep, penetrating meditative insights and at the same time can be somewhat psychologically immature people. Most of us likely know some stories of spiritual teachers with alcohol or rage problems or who have been involved in sex scandals. So meditation alone doesn't automatically solve all our unresolved problems. So I would say that we need all of these different selves, or these different selves and no selves, and that problems arise when we have an incomplete picture of who we are as people. Yet the number of approaches in the world today that include both of these approaches is basically zero. These two separate and independent paths of human development are what the philosopher Ken Wilber calls growing up and waking up. And Wilber says that whatever waking up experience a person has, it will always or can only be interpreted according to the stage of growing up that that person is at. He says, this is a quote, "Even if you have a profound enlightenment, this conventional self is the way through which the enlightened awareness will express itself in the conventional realm. And if this conventional self is bruised and broken, all you will get is the enlightened neurotics. Simply promoting things like mindfulness meditation will not help that fundamental problem, no matter how many enlightenment experiences you have. If you're at a lower egocentric level of growing up, you will be directly contributing to a polarized, isolated humanity." So to conclude, and then we'll have a little bit of time for discussion, what do we do about this? How do we work with this? So first of all, I would say, don't give up the Dharma. So I'm interested in how we might complement what we're already doing rather than changing. So a couple of considerations or practices that have been helpful my own experience. One we could call embodied immediacy, or letting yourself have your experience or the practice of personal responsibility. So the sense that I'm responsible for my experience, it's not my partner's responsibility or someone else's responsibility. So that we can, when we remember, make a conscious choice to intentionally touch into our experiential disturbances when we have them at a felt sensation level. So that when we're triggered, we're activated, we're upset, the practice would involve dropping the story, the narrative, the interpretation, the urgency to do something about it, and just checking in with the felt experience of what it's like being in our body. Because so much of neurosis comes from the sense that I just can't survive having the feeling that I'm having. So staying with your experience at the sensation level without needing to do anything about it can release some of the knots and lead to a deeper, more grounded experience of yourself. And often we find that there isn't an experience of abandonment or whatever our perceived core issue may be, but rather just strong sensations, which might be difficult. They might be excruciating even. But as a now adult, we can begin to make a more conscious choice to stay present with, rather than having to check out of the difficult experiences like we did when we were children. Another practice is working with our intimate relationships as a vehicle for awakening. So I heard one teacher say that it's in intimate relationships that where the rubber meets the road when it comes to our Dharma practice. Because it's in our relationships that we get most easily and deeply triggered. And it's easy to feel like we have our lives together and everything's going well when we're by ourselves or we're on meditation retreat or we're single. But that's not so much the case when we're in relation, an intimate relationship with other people. This is where many of our deepest habitual unresolved relational issues are guaranteed to be forced out into the open. One of the teachers that I like, physician Gabor Mate, says, "If I want to know about someone's childhood, I just need to see how they interact with their spouse when they are upset." So rather than numbing ourselves out to our uncomfortable experiences or trying to change our partners, the invitation in this case is to use our relational challenges as grist for the mill of our waking up and our growing up, and to use them as a vehicle, for waking up. So I have two quotes on that note to end with. One is from a Tibetan teacher, Sogyal Rinpoche, who I have this quote and I liked it and I looked up his name to make sure I was spelling it right. And the first thing that came up was an article from The Guardian or from some British newspaper talking about Tibetan Lama accused of sexual harassment and rage problems and alcoholism and... So then I thought, oh no, I'm not going to use the quote. But then I thought, well, I'm talking about neurotic, enlightened neurotic, so I'll still read it. So he says, and this is from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, whatever you do, don't shut off your pain. Accept your pain and remain vulnerable. However desperate you become, accept your pain as it is, because it is in fact trying to hand you a priceless gift. The chance of discovering, through spiritual practice, what lies behind sorrow. Grief, Rumi wrote, can be the garden of compassion. If you keep your heart open through everything, your pain can become your greatest ally in your life's search for love and wisdom. And a final quote from A.H. Almas, who's another spiritual teacher, says, "Your conflicts, all the difficult things, the problematic situations in your life are not chance or haphazard. They are actually yours. They are specifically yours, designed specifically for you by a part of you that loves you more than anything else. The part of you that loves you more than anything else has created roadblocks to lead you to yourself. You are not going to go in the right direction unless there is something pricking you in the side saying, "Look here, this way." That part of you loves you so much that it doesn't want you to lose the chance. It will go to extreme measures to wake you up. It will make you suffer greatly if you don't listen. What else can it do? That is its purpose. So we have a little bit of time for question or discussion. Raphael.
Should I use the microphone?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for the enlightenment. It sounds like you was going into something that I was reading, The Wisdom of the Enneagram. Hmm. And the essence of it is I'm not my personality. Mm-hmm. But I heard so much from you, and one thing that I was able to focus on was the problem, which you began with suffering, mm-hmm. and then the end of suffering. And how is that achieved, utilizing psychotherapy, meditation? And I think ultimately the solution is not so much to accept it, and I guess this is not a question, it's more of mm-hmm. a commentary, which I do appreciate everything that you shared. Not to accept it, but to see it. And what meditation and psychotherapy allows is to open the eyes, the mind's eye. And not only the mind's eye, but the feeling of whatever the experience was, from the past and even in the present. Mm-hmm. And by opening the mind's eye, then the opportunity is there not to be attached or not to disconnect from it. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like it was the essence of what you was just sharing. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I think that was a really nice articulation. And I think there are some similarities with... I don't understand a lot. I don't know the Enneagram very well, but I know one of the components of it is the idea that our personality develops sort of as a conglomeration of coping mechanisms. But I think, like you're saying, a lot of what Dharma practice involves is this sort of counterinstinctual move of turning towards what's difficult in our lives and allowing for it. And I think it has a lot to do with how we use pain and difficulty, the suffering in our lives, so that we make good use of it rather than making bad use of it, right? And I think a lot of Dharma practice can come down to, and therapy also can come down to, not making things worse, but that there can also be not necessarily, but one possible danger of just meditating is that if, say, we have anger come up and we're just noting anger's arising, it's not self, it's not personal, it's here, that if we can treat it with a similar sort of dissociative attitude with which that's kind of how it was put into the shadow realm in the first place, put it out of our conscious awareness. But I think, like you're saying, it can also, our Dharma practice can help hold it and allow it and increase our tolerance for being with it without having to be reactive or bringing some conscious awareness to how we choose to be, how we choose to react, or how we choose to act rather than unconsciously react.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Here and
okay. First, thank you for your Dharma talk. It was really kind of stimulating, and it actually brings to mind this kind of vexed kind of frustration that I have. It's been coming up for me, and so basically, I've been thinking a lot about whether or not, like, the Western theory of the mind and the kind of ways that we've kind of been taught to understand human psychology is based so much on this kind of Eurocentric model. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether or not that could actually be a hindrance to understanding the Dharma and the teachings of the Buddha, particularly when we overlay them. So I get to be more direct, I'm thinking like a Western model of the self being conflated with the kind of self that the Buddha was talking about, and then kind of bringing those two together, like whether or not that can actually be a hindrance. And so I always kind of think back, it's kind of been bothering me lately for a whole host of reasons, because there's a way in which, you know, I guess the way we think about the mind and ourselves is so much dictated by a white supremacist culture. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, have you given any thought to that at all in terms of you kind of pulling these two strands of thinking together, particularly the interpretation of mindfulness that's kind of been proliferated in popular culture?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I haven't thought a whole lot about it. I think the way I understand kind of what I presented was that there are these two paths or ways of approaching human experience, alleviating suffering, and that sometimes there's attempts to integrate them, kind of meld them together, and I see them as different, and that they can kind of coexist, and there can be some degree of contradiction even, and that can still work. But I do think, I mean, in like there's a lot of talk about like attachment and attachment theory in the psychological world, and there are these really dominant views that inform a lot of what's written and how things are understood, and attachment, for example, comes out of a model of, it comes out of Britain, the work of John Bowlby, and this model of kind of a nuclear family. And so I'm sure there are all kinds of blind spots that we're not taking into account. So, yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer, but I think it's important to look at. Yeah.
I initially just wanted to add to your description of how to sit with the experiences.
Sure.
Because I think one key thing that I found, I've got a background in psychotherapy, and I've blended it with my Buddhist practice for many decades. And I think it's really important to be aware of the feelings and to feel the feelings, mm-hmm. not just observe the feelings, but to sit with the feelings and allow them to have their own energy and to come up and rise and to stay with it and just watch it and to feel it until it completes and resolves and fades away on its own. Mm-hmm. I had experience of dealing with PTSD about 20 years ago, actually. And so I had the opportunity to apply what I knew and brought the mindfulness piece to it. And there would be times that I'd be feeling the intensity of the emotion, and I just wanted to get away from it. I resisted it. Mm-hmm. And there was the thing that really sort of saved me and worked me through it would be I would just get myself to sit. Okay, I'm going to sit. mm-hmm. until this feeling passes through. And just the sitting and the watching until the peace came was very healing for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for presenting what you've presented. It's really nice.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I think, let's go back here. Maybe we can get the mic and then here. I think that's, and just to comment while the mic is traveling, I think that that's an important distinction. And I know I've had times in my life, my earlier periods of practice, where I remember one instance in particular where I had a piece of really jarring, upsetting news, and my response was, oh, I'm going to go meditate. And it wasn't a sense of, oh, I'm going to really open to this disturbance and the uncomfortable feelings. It was that it almost had sort of a dissociative quality to it, that I'm going to do what I think will relax me in this moment, right? So we can use meditation just as we would use food or alcohol or something else, right? And I think that's for me in my own practice, that's been part of the what has developed for me being able to, and sometimes I'll sit and I'll just start crying, or there will be some emotion that will come through. And whereas I remember when I first had instructions about meditation here and hearing, well, being with your emotions and sensations of the body, I remember thinking, well, I don't have any emotions. What are they talking about?
Thank you very much. It's a fascinating talk. You know, I'm a little bit confused with the notion of the sort of bifurcated model of the ego, the Western one, and perhaps a Buddhist or whatever, because I'm sure I'm not alone in this, one of the attractiveness of Buddhism is that the Eightfold Path is the model of a healthy ego, virtually every other, I don't know how you would describe it, but model of wellness or well-adjusted adult and so on would embody what and in fact. The thing about the Eightfold Path is that it even goes further than most Western models in that it embodies both, you know, ethical, practical, spiritual, and even meditative and wisdom components that certainly are lacking in most Western models. Mm-hmm. So how do you square those things? Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, I remember reading... one of my favorite Dharma books is the little Bhikkhu Bodhi book on the Eightfold Path, which I know is one of Diane's books that she likes also. And I recommend it if it sounds interesting. It's a real short read, and he's a really clear, articulate writer. But I remember reading it and it feeling very exciting to me, but also thinking, wait, we have this, we're just in the West, or with how Dharma is manifesting in the way I see it, it's mostly about meditation and mindfulness. And when you see it from this perspective, it's really taken out of this holistic system, which it's meant to be one part of a variety of other parts. And so I had to kind of square away. And I remember talking to a teacher and saying, well, what? I think we're doing it wrong. So I think that that's true. And I think that there may also at the same time be other things that can be helpful from psychotherapy or some other approach. Like I said, it's for me, it's not so much about kind of being dogmatic in the approach, but with the intention of, or keeping in mind, what is our intention? Our intention is to alleviate suffering, to wake up, to have freedom. What is skillful means towards that goal? And when I'm talking about psychotherapy, I'm not necessarily advocating that everyone go out and do psychotherapy or get therapy. It's more just kind of an it could be a 12-step group, it could be some other approach, or it could also just be some kind of internal understanding of yourself from this perspective.
Well, just a follow-up question: does that seem to me that would indicate that sort of the Western approach dealt more with the trauma associated with whatever it is that's blocking an individual from, you know, becoming or achieving what they would like, and dealing with that? But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So, what's the question?
Well, is the usefulness of the Western approach more associated with, you know, with the suffering that can be alleviated through some sort of psychotherapeutic, program, the trauma itself that could not be alleviated as easily or readily or understood in a Buddhist approach?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, what occurs to me is just that there are different traditions arising in different places for any number of combinations of causes and conditions that we can't understand. But I think also, whereas a Buddhist approach is 2,600 years old, a lot of these understandings from this other model are relatively recent, from the past 80, 100, 150 years, and that there's some different understanding that we have about the human condition that has come from the past couple hundred years that we didn't have 2,500 years ago.
As you talk a little bit about the arc of these different paths to well-being and development over a 2,000-4,000 year history, I am amazed by how far people got towards well-being with the older paths. I just finished reading David Rico's book on transference, very current psychological discussion on projection and transference as saboteurs to personal relationships and how the past comes forward to the present, as you said. And I also just spent 2 days with a Zuni in the Pueblo, and the gentleman what I was with was discussing conversations he'd had with his father, and then he asked me to meet his mother, and I said, well, was I going to be able to meet his father as well? And he said, no, he passed away years ago. So in his philosophy and in his worldview, his father was still alive and present, and he was still having comforting guidance conversations with his ancestor, with his father, and he was still resolving challenges with his father in real conversation. And it was exactly what was playing out in Rico's writing of modern psychotherapy transference. But we, you know, I was getting that experience in stories about Zuni mythology and then how it was alive for him today. So it seems to me that there are challenges between the two paths or between all the paths, but there's also some points, and I'd like to know, maybe my question is, do you see points where the two illuminate each other, the paths really illuminate each other? I had read a line that was very close to something you just said, and I wanted to share it. It said, I'm going to leave it at that. But it just seems to me that there is this arc from the very old to the very current. And both are healing. And even in understanding where this goes beyond to a spiritual realm, that the world both provides us with the comfort and the challenges to become ourselves, and that is grace in a spiritual sense. And it's also part of psychotherapy, what the mother does for us, comfort, and the challenge of the father. So it even takes us right to the spiritual realm of grace. They are so all related. They seem to, when you start to think of them together, there's so much relationship and so much illumination that I think it can get very exciting. Mm-hmm. And the possibilities, I think, overwhelm the challenges of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think that, just real quick, like I said, I'm not advocating for a smorgasbord of just kind of take what suits you. I think really having a dedicated practice in the Dharma is, I think that's really wise. But I think also, like you're saying, there is so much overlap, and in a sense, it's the same project that we're working on regardless of how we enter into it. And I think it is in some ways a very exciting time to be involved with whatever you want to call it, spiritual path work or psychological work, in that we have tools at our disposal that humanity didn't have some 200 years ago or whenever. But at the same time, like you're saying, there can be this risk of kind of this Western arrogance that we're kind of discovering these things for the first time, and as brain scans report that the meditating monks doing loving kindness practice, these synapses light up and whatever happens, and the Buddhists roll their eyes and say that science is confirming these things that we've known for centuries.
This is a complicated subject and very vast, and what I want to say about it is that I was trained as a therapist, mm-hmm. and I've done a lot of study in spiritual stuff, but I'm just getting very comfortable and really liking this path with the insight meditation. It seems like a real natural bridge to everything I've experienced so far. But what I want to say that I see common to therapy and this practice is the relationship aspect, that's what's so healing. Mm-hmm. And I think it depends so much on the teacher or the therapist, you know, in any situation, and being seen and being held. And I think that's what they have in common. And sometimes you need the one-on-one therapeutic, you know, if you've had a lot of trauma or whatever you've had in your life, and you haven't ever had that kind of being seen and having someone really hear you. You know, therapy has its value, and I don't know how many people have, you know, gone through that process. I got to a point where I felt like, you know, what you said earlier about that it brings things to awareness and it brings a certain level of understanding. I then think that Buddhism or whatever your spirituality is brings a whole other level, brings that grace and spaciousness that really adds to the healing. Because just getting it intellectually, I mean, you can also get it emotionally in therapy, I'm not saying that, but there's just something about the grace that comes with the meditation and the spiritual path that doesn't necessarily come in therapy. And so if you're combining it with a therapist that also meditates, I think it has a lot of potential for healing. And so that's what I want to say.
Yeah, I think the sort of interpersonal component of it is really important. And whether it's with a therapist or in a group. Right. And we have this quote from the suttas about Ananda saying, looking out over, I'll probably say it wrong, but looking, with the Buddha looking out over this vast amount of practitioners, saying that community, Sangha, must be half of what's important in the spiritual life. And the Buddha says, don't say that, Ananda. It's all of the spiritual life, right? And I remember kind of rolling my eyes when I would hear that and think, oh, I'm an introvert. I don't really like talking to anyone. And I love going on retreat and because I can just kind of be in my own contained experience. But what I'm coming to realize is that I've been really missing out on something important, and that even from a therapeutic approach, there's this idea that we were hurt in relationship and we can heal, and we heal only in relationship. And this idea of really needing to feel feel safe, not just be safe, but to feel safe, right?
And the connection, whether it's within yourself through the meditation or with members of the group, or, you know, I'm in Matt's class, and I just love my class and everybody that was in it, and made me feel more comfortable coming here for the first time, knowing people and having that connection. And we don't get to go meditate in caves that often. We do have to, navigate this crazy world. So we need some kind of self to be able to interface with the world. It's just how attached to it are we. Right. You know, that's what I would say.